Welcome to ATS Mix.
And I think until you start asking questions, you know, you're just going to buy whatever's offered to you on the 6 o'clock news.
ATS Mix.
This isn't a talk show, it's a freak show.
From AboveTopSecret.com.
But also be skeptical of the people who are out there selling conspiracy theories.
The Internet's most popular conspiracy theory discussion board. ATS Mix from AboveTopSecret.com.
In the name of Christ, just let us in!
Starts now.
And welcome to the ATS Mix Show. It's 106, and I'm Johnny Anonymous.
Yes, and I'm his partner, Dave Rabbit. And speaking
yes,
of being, what do you think, John? Great show or not?
I'm thinking that it's going to be a hot show. We'll get to that in a little while. Let's talk about something else that's equally as important. How can our friends, our members, our listeners subscribe to our show? Could it be any easier now?
You know, I think it could, John and Ader. In fact, we've made it so easy that along with our host of the other sister shows, Spencer Tracy and Doc Hancock at the BTS Mix, and of course, Martin Bain and Homer Fife with the Above Politics Show, it's extremely, extremely easy now, John, to subscribe to each of the sister shows, including our show.
How extremely easy can it be? Well, now each show thread has two shortcuts. And when you click on it, you can download the shows with either iTunes or with our RSS feed. Remember, your subscription helps bring our intelligent community to the entire world.
Also remember that if you've ever had your shortcut clicked, you know how it feels. So come join us all. Deny ignorance with the ATS Mix Show with Johnny Anonymous and yours truly, his sometimes and sometimes not partner, Dave Rabbit.
Or you could deny boredom with the BTS Mix Show with Spencer Tracy and Doc Hancock.
And, of course, deny apathy with the Above Politics Show with Martin Bain and newcomer Homer Fife.
And you, too, can be part of the revolution. The Above Network, LLC. Now that we got that out of the way, let's remind people of why this month is so special. This is the month of November, and last year we had, remember, the 5th of November. And
we weren't there, but everybody celebrated. We saw them on TV. Remember that?
I remember that.
Remember that huge thing? And I sat there with popcorn, had cold drinks and stuff right there in front. The only thing I saw was the Krakenator.
I kept seeing Lumbozo. Anyway, yeah. One of the guests that they had there was Jim Mars. And we were fortunate enough to be able to get Jim Mars in an exclusive interview since he has currently just written a book entitled Above Top Secret. Imagine that. What a great name.
Go figure. Hey, I don't know how this guy does it, you know? Where did he get a name like that, John? I have no idea.
Who knows? Anyway, yeah. We had such a good time. In fact, we had about 3 hours worth of a good time with Jim that this interview we did with him, we have to break it down into two parts. So when it ends kind of abruptly, you're going to know why. It's because it's just too good for one show. We have to break it up into two shows. Too much information. Too much information!
Yeah, but we want to say one last thing.
All right.
Thank you, thank you, thank you to all the members that contributed to this two-part interview with Jim Mars. And we want to apologize to anybody that didn't get their question asked because 3 hours, you know, we threw in the white flag. Jim was just taking us to task.
Wow, your sincere side sounds pretty convincing, Dave.
Then I'm not doing it right, John.
The following is an ATS Mix exclusive interview.
These aren't the right wristbands. Yes, they are.
Well, Dave, this is going to be a red letter day for all our listeners and members of AboveTopSecret.com. We have with us a very special guest, and I know that you've got to be sitting on pins and needles, considering that he's a fellow Texan.
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, that's the thing that excites me most. I don't care about the book. I just, you know, like talking to Texans, you know.
Yes, and I apologize for his comment about not caring about the book. He does care about the book. He's joking with everybody. Let me tell you who we are speaking of. With over 30 years of experience, our special guest, Jim Mars, is an award-winning journalist. In 1999, at perhaps one of the first universities to ever offer a UFO course in the nation, he began teaching a course on UFOs. Before it was publicly acknowledged by the CIA, Jim investigated the U.S. Army's remote viewing program. He did this 3 years prior before them going public about the program. He's produced such bestsellers as Alien Agenda, Rule by Secrecy, The Rise of the Fourth Reich, and now the newly released book, Above Top Secret. His website is located at www.jimmarrs.com. That's J-I-M-M-A-R-R-S.com. And also is a conspiracy pro here at AboveTopSecret.com with his very own area entitled The View from Mars. It's with great pleasure right now that we welcome to the ATS Mix the incredible, and I've never been able to use this word with a guest, but I'm going to use it now, and astute, Mr. Jim Mars. Hi, Jim.
Hey, guys. It's really great to be with you. Astute, there's a new one.
Yeah, it's not to be confused with that thing that's on your front porch. What's that called?
Well, I thought it had something to do with my beard, you know, but I think that's hair suit.
And I'm going to tell our listeners right now that being from a foreign country of California, as my partner so says, I stand no chance at all with two Texans on the show today.
and a good indication of that would be that although the show just started a minute and a half ago, Jim and I have been having an old home week for like 30 minutes in the pre-show chat. So we've worn Johnny out before we've even got started. Hey, Jim, you know, I just want to put on the air how excited I am to get a chance to finally talk to you. I really had hoped that Johnny and I both were going to be able to meet you personally last year on the 5th of November extravaganza in New York City. How did you enjoy that?
Well, that was incredible. That was such a really neat event. And, I'm sorry that you guys didn't make it. I'm not sure what the excuse was. Y'all got drunk or something. I don't know.
Yeah, that may have been what they told you. I don't think that was the real reason.
That was not it, of course. No, that was, it's really exciting to have that anniversary of Above Top Secret, because Above Top Secret has just grown into this, just this, you know, international phenomena, and I'm very pleased to be a part of it.
You know, I am 60, you're 64 going on 65, you're from Fort Worth, I'm from Dallas. The thing I really we talked about earlier is the close proximity that we share and the history that we share to a degree, in that when all the things transpired, for instance, and we'll get into it in detail, but like with the Kennedy assassination or whatever, I mean, we're right here in the back door of what's going on, and that's what I find really amazing.
It is pretty amazing, and that just as I was coming of age and just as I had committed myself to the profession of journalism, there probably one of the biggest stories at that time, of course, the Kennedy assassination, just happened right in my own backyard.
What age was it, Jim, that you first started getting interested in conspiracies? And do you recall what particular subject it was that made you scratch your forehead and go, hey, this just doesn't sound right?
Yes. First off, I was always an alert kid. And I read voraciously. I read everything I could get my hands on. In fact, by the time I was in like the fifth and sixth grade, I'd already read all of what is considered like the classic books, you know, Tale of Two Cities, Ivanhoe, things like that. And I had already begun to turn my attention to speculative fiction, as it was called then. Now it's called science fiction, but they hadn't even, I was reading science fiction before they even coined the word. And I can pretty well pinpoint, because there was an incident in West Texas, near Leveland, where a giant UFO landed on the highway, and everybody's cars were stalling out. Some managed to get away, and they notified the state police, and they went out there, and their cars died, and they all just sit there and watched this thing, and then it finally lifted up and went away. And this was covered in the newspapers at the time. And, as a kid in Fort Worth, I was reading those stories avidly, and the reason I can pinpoint this is because I actually drew a watercolor painting of this UFO on the highway based on the news reports that I'd been reading at the time. And I stumbled across that a few years back, amongst all the junk hidden in the attic. So I went back to check to see when this Leveland incident happened, and it happened in 1957. So I've been onto strange things, been trying to figure out what's really going on since at least 1957. About 1962 or 3, I was editor of the Campus Chat, the campus newspaper at the University of North Texas. And somebody recently sent me an editorial that I'd written at that time saying, you know, there seems to be something serious going on with these stories of flying saucers. And I think it deserves serious investigation. And so there was another time frame that I could pinpoint. So I've kind of always been after the strange and the fringe and the ultra.
The new book that you have, in fact, I believe it's already released right now. It's entitled Above Top Secret. When our listeners and members purchase this book, what do they have to look forward in the book? What's really the book about, Jim?
Well, it's got everything, including the kitchen sink. what we do is look at a variety of topics that interest a lot of people and that we do not have firm and conclusive answers to. Strange, mysterious, conspiratorial. Was 9/11 an inside job? Did John Titor come from the future? Is the supply of oil peaking? Why did the Air Force change its story on the Stephenville UFO sightings? And who built the spidery drones? What hovered over O'Hare Gate C-17? Is free or alternative energy being kept from the public? Is the Federal Reserve a scam? Who killed Kennedy? Is there a Nazi base in Antarctica? Is God an alien? What'll happen in 2012? That's just a few of the section headings that I deal with, and I take it from the journalist standpoint. I go for the who, what, when, where, and why.
Well, what everybody may not know is, and of course I do, is not only do you hail from Fort Worth, but I used to deliver the paper, Fort Worth Star-Telegram, and you were a person of interest in that particular paper, were you not?
That's true. I worked for the Star-Telegram for about a dozen years. Started off as a police reporter, and in fact, it's interesting, guys. I graduated from the University of North Texas with a degree in journalism and minors in English and history. Then I spent 2 years out at Texas Tech at Lubbock, Texas, in graduate school, taking a wide variety of things. I took courses in psychology, anthropology, criminology, you name it. Every kind of ology there was, I think I studied it at one time or another. And that's why that I guess I became the last of a dying breed. I'm a generalist. I know a little bit about a lot of things, and I try to correlate all those things and put them together and see what the big picture is. And, of course, today in modern America, we have been turned into a specialist society. Everybody knows their own little speciality. Doctors know medicine, lawyers know legal matters, and, you know, unfortunately, there doesn't seem to be a place for an old-time philosopher, somebody who knows a little bit about a lot of things and tries to put the big picture together. But that's what I try to do. So when I got out of graduate school and returned to Fort Worth, it was kind of interesting because at that time, journalism was wide open. In fact, when I came back to the Dallas-Fort Worth area, I was offered a job at the Dallas Times-Herald, the Dallas Morning News, the Associated Press, the Fort Worth Press, and the Fort Worth Star-Telegram.
Well, you better be glad you didn't work for the Herald.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, they went out of business.
And the reason I chose the Star-Telegram over the rest was two reasons. Number one, it was my old hometown newspaper, so I thought that was pretty cool to be writing for my own hometown newspaper. And the second reason is, they said, we'll make you the police reporter and you'll have your own mobile unit. So I had car with a radio in it, and I could chase all the ambulances and the police calls and get in on the chases and go out to the crashes and the wrecks and everything else. And it was pretty exciting for a young guy fresh out of college. I was an ambulance chaser, but I was chasing it to get the story, to find out what happened.
Well, you know, Jim, one thing that is really a hot button for me, and I have to tell you, I do not read. I just am not a big book reader. But
it isn't so.
It isn't so. No, it really is so. But I read this from cover to cover. we were privy to the an advanced copy so that we could do some study, if you will, before we had you on air. But I, not only was I very impressed with your writing style, Jim, and I mean that is a huge compliment, considering that I don't have a lot to compare them to, since I don't read anybody else. But you were the only author that I have read, and I did read one when I was a kiddo. I lied about that. But
let's get to the question.
I am just complimenting our guest that I was very enthralled with it.
Yeah, don't stop his compliments, please.
Yeah. Hey, you Californians, just shut up, will you? I'm complimenting the fellow Texan. Anyway, I really enjoyed the book, and I did physically read it. Now, to my question.
Thank you.
Thank you. The thing that, of all the different topics, there's two of them that really appeal to me, and I want to ask you one of them, and that is about the JFK thing. You're from Fort Worth. I'm from Dallas. I'll never forget the day that Kennedy was assassinated. I'm in L.V. Stockard Junior High School in Dallas. I'm walking down the hallway. I hear the teachers screaming at the top of their lungs as we're changing classes, and there's all kinds of furor going on, and I remember a teacher, I was right outside of my locker, and the teacher comes screaming out, and she says, the president's been shot. And there was so much chaos in the school, but at the time that she screamed at the top of her lungs, the president has been shot, the hallway went deaf. I mean, it was just such a smack you in the face kind of thing. And I want to know, you know, the thing I love about the thing that you did with Oliver Stone is that not only was it a tremendous movie that you had a tremendous amount of input on, but I was actually in the movie as an extra in the Jack Ruby scene. And, you know, this will go on for 1,000 years, but
like this question is,
will you stop it? Who, in your estimation, Jim, do you believe killed JFK?
Well, it just depends on where you want to stop with your thinking, you know. I'm always asked, well, what's the bottom line? What's the bottom line? You know, I don't want to hear all this background. I don't want to hear all this explanation. Just tell me who killed Kennedy. So in 25 words or less, President John F. Kennedy was shaking up the status quo, and the status quo struck back. That's the bottom line. Now, what does that mean? Well, that means is that by the fall of 1963, President Kennedy had just about angered every powerful and violent faction in this country. His brother Robert Kennedy, as Attorney General, was prosecuting the mafia as never before or since. He was secretly ordering a shutdown of Vietnam, and it seems very probable that had he lived past the 64 election, we would have pretty much pulled out of Vietnam. We would not have had the Vietnam War that cost 58,000 American lives and damaged hundreds of thousands of others. He also was trying to curtail the power of the multinational corporations. His 1962 Kennedy Tax Act was shutting down their tax loopholes. He was trying to make them pay their fair share of taxes. And then probably most important of all, he was trying to curtail the power of the Federal Reserve System, which is neither federal nor has any reserves. It is a collection of 12 private banks that are in turn owned by other private banks, which are in turn owned by private individuals, many of which are not even United States citizens. And, of course, they're the ones who control our money supply. This was something that Thomas Jefferson warned us about. He said if you ever allow bankers to gain control over your money supply, you'll wake up your grandchildren and great-grandchildren will wake up without property in the country that we have founded. And when I look around at all of the apartments and condominiums and people paying on their credit cards and paying on their cars and paying on their TVs and electronics and their iPods, You know, it's true. Most of us don't own anything. We're just renting, and we're just there paying. So Kennedy was trying to change that situation. He, through his Secretary of the Treasury, he was trying to curtail the power of the Fed. And in fact, in June of 1963, Kennedy issued something like $4.2 billion in currency that was issued through the Treasury Department, not through the Federal Reserve System. And what's the difference? Because when we issue it through the Treasury Department, we don't have to pay interest to anyone. When we issue it through the Federal Reserve System, then they are authorized to issue the money, and then we have to pay them interest on the money that they generate essentially out of thin air. There's only been one other president in the history of the United States who attempted to issue interest-free money, and that was Abraham Lincoln, who issued the greenbacks during the war between the states to finance the war. And, fellas, I don't think it is just some sort of coincidence that both Lincoln and Kennedy were shot in the head in public.
You know, and there's a lot of people that have kind of discussed the similarities with President-elect Obama with JFK, and I was just kind of curious what your thoughts are on our new president-elect. Also, the fact that we've had that you were talking about the Fed and the government wanting to own all the property, we've just had this huge bailout, and it looks like they're even going to throw more money into the mass. What do you think this new president-elect is going to have on his table when he steps into office, and will he be able to handle it?
Well, you mentioned this big bailout. I didn't get any check, did you?
No, I didn't get no check. Did you, Dave?
It really is pretty incredible because it went to the very people who caused the problem in the first place.
Yeah.
Excuse me, but if you hit somebody with your car, you are held responsible, right?
That's right.
And if these people run their companies into the ground, then they should be held responsible, not given a bailout.
That's right.
It's incredible. In fact, if they wanted to have a true, workable, fair, and equitable bailout, what they should have done was take that $800 billion as finally authorized in the Senate version, and they should have just sent out checks to everyone in this country over age 18, everyone of legal age, and everybody gets a piece of it. And when you figure most families are at least two people, maybe three or four, that could come up to a few $100,000. Then they could all pay off their mortgage. They could pay off their student loans. And then with whatever's left over, they go out and buy cars and electronics and food, clothing, and all that would, of course, be handled through their bank account, so that'd take care of the banking crisis.
Exactly.
And the whole country would be back on its feet. But no, all that money went to those clods up on Wall Street that got us into the problem in the first place.
Yeah.
Now, as to Barack Hussein Obama, and I stress...
Send those U2Us to Jim Mars.
Hey, people don't read. You know, Dave, you said it yourself. You don't read.
That's right.
So, see, you haven't read the Dreams of My Father, his autobiography. And in there, Obama says, if the going gets tough, I will side with the Muslims.
Wow.
I don't know. That kind of causes me a little concern.
Sure.
But he is smooth. He does have that charisma. And then that's kind of a concern, too, come to think of it, because I am no astrologer, but I have kept up with credible astrologers as just another little facet of things that kind of interests me. And I am being told that Barack Obama's astrological chart is eerily similar to that of John F. Kennedy and of Abraham Lincoln. That doesn't bode very well.
Yep.
But then maybe he can avoid any kind of similar type situation, because what I have come to the realization of is that, in fact, just this past weekend, I was at the Crash Retrieval Conference and met with a fellow named Bill Holden. Bill, back in the early 60s, worked on Air Force One. I think he was the loadmaster. And he told this story that in the summer of 1963, they were in Europe. He was in Europe with President Kennedy. And that there were some stories in the European media about UFOs. And he said Kennedy, unlike other presidents, was really quite approachable. And so when he had the chance, he said, Mr. President, he said, what do you think about UFOs? And he said, President Kennedy thought seriously for a moment and then said, I would like to tell the people about the alien situation. He said, but my hands are tied.
Wow.
So all the way back then to President Kennedy, to President Reagan, who got shot right off the bat, and George Herbert Walker Bush then ran the country for a while, all the way up to Jimmy Carter, and he was threatened with assassination by Raymond Lee Harvey and Oswaldo Ortiz. And now that sounds like some kind of cruel joke, but it actually happened. And the point being is that the president is not in charge.
Right.
He may be the supreme commander-in-chief. He may be the chief executive officer. He may be the leader of the free world. But he's not in charge. And nothing's going to change significantly until we figure out who is in charge and figure out how to get a little leverage over them.
We have a number of listeners and members alike, Jim, that posted a number of questions at AboveTopSecret.com. In fact, there's more pages than I've ever seen for any of our guests that we've had before. Dave, is that correct, Dave?
So it's a new world's record for number of questions, yeah.
Well, listen, and my answers are free, okay?
Okay,
but,
good.
But wait, truthful answers are $5.
Okay. All right, now I just got one bone to pick with you, Mr. Mars.
Is that all?
Yeah, just one. And my bone is, I tell Johnny, I say, well, you know, I'm going to put this question thread up for Jim and blah, blah, blah. And of course, we made you aware of it so you would be aware of the questions that were being asked. And then I log on one day, and here you are answering the questions on the thread. I'm going,
Oh, no. Well,
what is he doing?
Guys, I just got to plead ignorance, okay? I am a computer goof. Instead of a computer geek, my computer is like my car. You know, I can turn on the key, I can drive it, but I have no idea how it works, and I have no idea how computers work. And I have a situation set up where I am answering these questions on my forum, The View from Mars, and those questions popped up, and they were sent to me, and I just thought there were more questions, so I just kept answering them, and I apologized to anybody and everybody for not understanding that this was just some questions that were put up there for my consideration, not necessarily for answering. So.
Well, I'm just teasing. I didn't really have a bone to pick with. You didn't really answer that many. So.
No, that was just my computer stupidity. You know, the Internet is really a wonderful thing, but it's got an upside and a downside. The upside of the Internet is that everybody and anybody has access to the Internet. And, of course, the downside is that anybody and everybody has access to the Internet. So you just have to know what you're doing, and you have to be very discerning when you go on the Internet, because you have to be able to pick out the wheat from the chaff. And sometimes it's not easy. And in fact, guys, actually, I think that was one of the primary reasons for me writing Above Top Secret. To touch on some of the more controversial and mysterious issues of today and try to bring it down to as factual and as...
Uh-oh.
We lost him. Okay, I'm going to add him back. Okay.
I have no idea what happened. I didn't touch anything.
Here's what I find amazing about it. You're talking about the Internet and how goofy it is, and then suddenly the Internet decides that they want to kill us.
Yeah, no, it makes my conspiratorial hackles.
Yes, I bet.
Hey, listen, you're preaching to the choir on that. You would be amazed at the number of times Johnny and I do interviews and stuff, and just bizarre, weird things happen when we start talking about subjects. So it really sends our little antennas
up. It's happened to me too, and it's not just the Internet. It's always struck me kind of strange is that. You know, I get every circular and advertising piece and bills, they always arrive through the mail right on time. And yet, when it's some piece of information or it's a check I'm expecting, somehow they get, you know, shredded or delayed or something. I don't know. It's just very strange.
I've always thought it kind of strange that we have so widely accepted the Internet, although it was created. Wasn't it created by the Army?
For the military.
For the military, yeah.
Right.
For the military. Of course, most things are. You know, the interstate highway system, everybody got thinks, oh, that's wonderful. Hey, that was created for the military. It wasn't created for the civilians. We were just lucky enough to get to use it some. That's why it has to, in each state, they have to conform to certain guidelines and criteria to be designated an interstate. And for one thing I know is it has to be designed to handle 90-mile-an-hour traffic, okay?
Wow.
So when they set the speed limit at 70, that's 20 miles below what it's engineered for. Also, on any interstate, every certain number of miles, you have to have like 3 miles of totally straight highway, and that's so that in the case of a national emergency, they use it as a landing field.
Interesting.
Landing strip.
All right, well, let's get back to our questions. We were just getting ready to get into some member questions here. And
okay.
Going to apologize to our listeners and members alike if Dave or I mispronounce your listener or member name. Sorry. And also I want to apologize to all the numerous members and listeners that have posted questions. Guess what, folks? We're not going to be able to get to all of them. So we're kind of going down the line here and trying to pick the ones that aren't duplicates.
You know, that's really something coming from somebody named Rabbit and Anonymous.
Scary, isn't it?
Here is a member who has a great name. His name or her name is It's the Question. And this is kind of a long-winded question, but I'll attempt to do it as best as I can. Mr. Mars, how interwoven are the various Uber powers that apparently control our government, banking systems, resources, religions, medical industries, entertainment diversions, etc.? And I wonder if there are competing factions or if, despite vast compartmentalization, the power structure in the world is ultimately a singularly top-down pyramid. And if this is the case, who or what is at the top of this pyramid?
Well, that's the $64,000 question.
Yeah.
You know, when the little flying saucer lands and the little green guy gets out, what does he say? He says, take me to your leader. Well, who is our leader? You know, Russian President Putin doesn't speak for the earth.
Right.
President Bush certainly doesn't speak for the earth. Most people don't even think he speaks for the United States. So it is a good question. In my research and in my experience and my knowledge, yes, there is a pyramid of power, particularly in the United States, that probably extends to Europe, to the European community, the European Union. But yes, there are circles within the circles, and there are competing factions under this. But you keep going towards the top, and you find that many of these multinational corporations have interlocking boards of directors, and then they have owners who may not even be visible. And when you keep moving up, you find that these owners and the heads of these multinational corporations are members of what I call secretive societies. It's not that we don't know they exist. It's simply that we can't join and we're not privy to their inner workings. Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, and then the inner core of those two secretive societies meet once a year under the name Bilderbergers. The Bilderbergers are so secretive that they don't even have a proper name. They're called the Bilderbergers because they were first discovered meeting over in Holland in 1954 in the Bilderberg Hotel. So since then, they've been known as Bilderbergers, and these are very high officials of governments, the owners and the chief executive officers of large multinational corporations, to include British, not just British, but European royalty. And so then you have to understand that they have commonalities of purpose and of agendas. But then, as in any organization, there are some who have more power than the others, some who have more influence than the others. And that takes us right on up to the top of the pyramid. And like I said earlier, the good thing about corporatism, as stated by the Italian dictator Benito Mussolini, He said fascism probably is not the correct term. It more likely should be corporatism, rule by the corporations. And as scary and as dictatorial as that may sound, it actually may offer us, the public, a chance for some input, because there are more of us than there are of them. And if we could simply get our act together, then we could exert tremendous influence over these giant corporations with our purchasing power. If we all decided, for example, that we were not going to buy any products that contain the sweetener aspartame, which is more and more being shown to cause cancer in lab animals and all kinds of problems, that was rushed through despite the opposition of federal certification officers by Donald Rumsfeld back in the 80s, they would quit making products with aspartame. And we could exercise our power that way. But that requires a population of people who study, who learn things other than just through the TV, who read and who contemplate and try to gain a little bit of knowledge and wisdom. I hope that's not asking too much.
Not at all.
But back to the question about who runs everything, if you've read my book, Rule by Secrecy, you find that these secret societies can be tracked back all the way back to the ancient mysteries of Greece and Egypt, and even beyond that to the what appears to be the founding civilization on this planet, which was the Sumerians of Sumer, which is now the one place in the world where we really can't travel to, and that's Iraq. Apparently it all started between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. And according to the ancient tablets, cuneiform tablets that were, this was, stylus was used to impress the characters of the language into mud, and then the mud was baked into stone. And we now have about 500,000 of these tablets scattered around the world in all the museums, and only about 20% of them have been translated. But those that have been translated tell us that several hundred thousand years ago, the Anunnaki came. And the Anunnaki have been translated as those who came from the heavens to the earth.
Right.
And they came to the earth, and they began to colonize this world. It's really amazing. And you can actually read the story of the Anunnaki in the Encyclopedia Britannica, but you're not going to find it under science or space exploration or anything like that. You're going to find it under Sumerian mythology, because when they began to translate these Sumerian tablets back in the mid-1800s, and they talked about flying through the air and destroying whole cities with one blast and cloning and altering the DNA of certain species, of course, those people had no idea what they were talking about, because none of that was known. And as a result, all of this history got written off as mythology. Today, no one is seriously arguing over the translation of these tablets, but they are arguing over the interpretation. Conventionally today, it's still considered that this is just mythology. They're gods and they're demigods. But a growing number of scholars are arguing that, hey, perhaps they would put down in their writings what they knew to be true or what they had actually experienced, instead of just some pipe dream that they were putting down as their mythology. It's all very fascinating. But if that's the case, and if there's any truth to these tablets, then it could be that at the very top of the power pyramid in the world today, they may not even be us.
Wow. Speaking about they may not be even be us, I want to go to a question that I have for you, Jim, and it's in one of the chapters in your book entitled, Is God an Alien? I have always kind of believed the last several years, especially being a member of AboveTopSecret.com and reading all the things on the site here, but I really have gotten to a point where I really have strong beliefs that all the miraculous things that supposedly Jesus did back in those days and all the powers and whatever was because he was an extraterrestrial, not of this earth, and that it was from an intelligent species. Now, in your book, you say, is God an alien? So what is your take on that philosophy?
Well, When you talk about God and you talk about Jesus, you're kind of talking apples and oranges. While they may be connected, they're not particularly the same thing. For those who believe that Jesus was the Son of God, then he's the Son of God. So we're talking separate entities here. So what I discussed in Is God an Alien is the concept of God. Now, if you accept God as some person or some entity outside of you, in other words, the guy up in the sky with the big G on his sweatshirt or whatever, then obviously he's not you and he's not human. Well, that essentially just by definition would make God an alien, okay, because he's alien to us humans. But if you join a growing number of people who see the concept of God as a sentient, creative energy force that surrounds all things and is in all things, then that kind of makes us a part of God, just like the concept that Jesus was the Son of God, which means we're all part of this same cosmic creative force, which means that, no, he's not an alien any more than your brother and sister is, because we're all related through this sentient creative energy.
Right.
Does that make any sense to you?
Sure. Lots of sense.
Which is
so
amazing.
Once again, and this won't be the only time that this comes up in this discussion, it kind of comes down to each individual's belief system. If you believe that God is separate from you, then he's definitely an alien. If you think that you are part of God and he is part of you, then he's not.
Hmm. Wow. That's something to ponder over with a margarita and some Mexican food.
Yeah.
Exactly. Need a few more margaritas for that one, I think. Let me give you an example. Maybe because most everybody on your forum they're operating their computers. So let's look at the computer. A computer is made out of plastic and cardboard and wiring, and in and of itself is not much. But yet, when it's fired up and operating properly, then it actually gets to the point of having artificial intelligence. It can not only compute, but it can actually begin to make decisions, and it can change. Anybody's played these new video games and stuff. You know, you go in, and the guy behind the door shoots you. So you go in the next time, you say, well, I know he's behind the door, so I get him, but hey, this time he's not there. The artificial intelligence has already changed and changed the situation in response to your behavior. So that's pretty amazing. So what is it that makes this artificial intelligence? It's not the plastic or the motherboard or the soldering. It is the energy sparks, the bytes of energy that collectively produce this artificial intelligence. One little byte is essentially meaningless, but billions of bytes, and you can have a picture and speech and artificial intelligence. It's amazing. Okay, now let's extrapolate that up. Johnny, you're a spark of energy. And when I say that, I mean this is scientifically provable. We all know that there's an electromagnetic energy field around every living person.
Yes.
Every living thing, actually. Some people call it the aura, okay? But there is this energy field, and fascinatingly enough, they have found that when a person dies, this energy field does not just disappear or dissipate. It simply rises up and goes off somewhere else, which, of course, would tend to prove the old scientific line that energy can be neither created nor destroyed. It can only change form.
Right.
So we are individual sparks of energy, but we have a spark of sentient, self-aware energy. We're all self-aware. We know we're somebody and we know we're thinking. But individually, we're just another spark of energy. But collectively, you put all the sparks of energy together like you put the bytes together in your computer, and I can see where you would have one cohesive, huge mass of sentient, self-aware energy that pervades all things and therefore is omnipresent and also omnipotent, which pretty well fits the definition of God, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Wow. Really?
Quick question for you, Jim. With what you've just related to us, do you think that there is a point in time, and I apologize to our listeners and members as we seem to be moving away from some of the member questions, but a couple of sidebars here, since Jim's comments are so interesting, Dave and I have to jump in every once in a while. Do you think with what you've just related to us, is it possible that artificial intelligence could get to a point at some time or another to where it itself starts creating other artificial intelligence like a god?
Or like the Terminator.
Or like the Terminator, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. And, you know, and having read science fiction since the 50s, I'm well aware of that possibility and that danger, which is we create a artificial intelligence that gets so intelligent that it decides it doesn't want any competition. Or better yet, I remember a story where they had a supercomputer and they programmed it to ensure that there would be no more war. So right. The machine sets out to kill off the human race. No more human race, no more war.
Right.
Ah.
So yeah, that's a danger there, you know. And if you go back and understand that we, meaning the human race today, is most likely the product of genetic tweaking by extraterrestrials. That's one theory that's advanced and that makes a lot of sense and has a lot to back it up. Again, harking back to the Sumerian tablets, then you would think that, you know, they too would be a little concerned about creating, let me pause here. We're not talking about creating a race, okay?
Right.
We're talking about tweaking the existing species, just like we do with horses, cows, pigs, dogs, cats. We breed them to get a better breed, or to make a stronger breed, or a prettier breed, or whatever. And this would be the same thing, except they might have gone one step beyond simple breeding, and that would be tweaking with the DNA. But that's not truly creating anything. I think creation still belongs in the sphere of God. But just as we change the breeds, try to improve the breeds, I think that may have been done to us. This, of course, would explain why we've never been able to find the missing link between Neanderthal and Cro-Magnon, because there is none. Neanderthal was genetically tweaked until they had Cro-Magnon, which is modern man.
Wow.
I want to try to get back onto some of these member questions, because there are so many of them.
That's where I was going, bro.
Okay.
Right.
Do you want to do Maria Stardust, or you want me to?
I would love to do Maria Stardust. All right. Sorry, Maria. We don't mean that in a disrespectful way. This question is from one of our valued people, Maria Stardust, and her question is this, Jim. In wake of the Stephenville sightings, which you and I is kind of like it's our back door, do you feel the disclosure by the powers that be is coming soon about what took place down there?
Yes, I do. In fact, I just came back from the 6th annual crash retrieval conference in Las Vegas, and the consensus seemed to be that among the researchers and the participants that we are entering into a new era of openness and straight talk about the UFO phenomena. Now, don't get me wrong. I do not anticipate now or possibly forever a press conference at the Pentagon where some ranking officer gets up and says, okay, folks, we lied to you for 60 years. Here's the truth. No, that ain't going to happen. But I think we can see, especially in the wake of the Stephenville sightings earlier this year, that there is a more openness and a more willingness to address in a serious manner the question of UFO. And we've seen at least half a dozen Larry King programs. We've seen an ABC special where they did not have the usual snickering and eye rolling. And I'm not going to say that we've turned the corner, but yes, I think we're definitely at the corner. But let me add that this disclosure and this openness, I don't believe, is the result of conscious decisions made within our government. You know, hey, it's time to tell people the truth. I think this decision has been made for us by the ongoing sightings, abductions, cattle mutilations, crop circles that are still going on and that are drawing the attention of more and more people. So I think the powers that be understand that the issue is rapidly getting out of their hands. Think about it, guys. If a UFO was to appear over a modern major American city and hang there for more than 30 minutes or an hour in time for the TV crews to get there, the game would be up, wouldn't it?
Oh, yes.
Well, I get. I want to stop you real quick, Jim, because you bring an interesting question in. Johnny, I apologize. Did you live in Fort Worth in the early 50s?
Yes.
Do you remember the UFO sighting that happened over Dallas? And if I'm not mistaken, I think it was 1952, 51, 53, somewhere along that line. Do you remember that?
That doesn't come back to me immediately, but I know that there have been sightings all around there for years. I do remember the Lubbock sightings where the formation of lights flew over Lubbock, Texas, and that was about that same time period.
Well, the reason why I ask you that is that that was my first experience of seeing a UFO. There was like 13 that was over the Dallas area, and our entire neighborhood got out in the middle of the street, and the parents would get out there with their, you know, with their telescopes and stuff, and it was just an amazing thing. And it ended up coming up on the Project Blue Book documentary several years later that were trying to debunk all those things. I was just curious, since you were in Fort Worth at the same time.
Do you recall how they tried to explain that? Was there anything saying
atmosphere? They said it was atmosphere. You know, 13 going, yeah. You know, going in formation. You know, going across the sky, stopping. You know, going directions. The people that saw it weren't buying it, and that's what made me a believer of the whole phenomenon of it.
Exactly. Well, that comes back to control over the media. These people who want to control us and who want to control information, they can't control every reporter, photographer, editor out here in the countryside, but they certainly can control the distribution of the information.
Right.
And so something like that happens in Dallas. It never goes anywhere else. The people there for the rest of their life say, I swear I saw something. Right. But then nobody else knows anything about it. That's been quite effective in curtailing the general understanding and knowledge regarding UFOs. I recall in 1997 when my brother was living in Phoenix, so I became aware of the lights that were seen over Phoenix there in March of 97. And at that same time, I was traveling, and I went to Atlanta, Georgia, and they were having a UFO thing there. They were also, before I left, there was some photographs published in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram of a UFO, and they treated it fairly seriously, saying, I wonder what this is. And, of course, the reason for that is that the picture had been taken by their own staff photographer, so they couldn't very well say, well, this guy's a nut, you know. But the point being that here was three serious UFO incident sightings, experiences taking place in Phoenix, Fort Worth, Dallas, and Atlanta, and yet when I traveled to those three places, none of them had heard of the others. That's control of the information, and that's how they've kept it out. If there was something in the New York Times, maybe a little box down at the corner of the front page, and it said something like 23 UFO sightings this week, and then next week, you know, 14 UFO sightings this week, something that would keep it in the consciousness of the reading public, and then, you know, it wouldn't take very many weeks before people go, whoa, something's going on here, you know. But when they keep it, the distribution choked off, and most people don't even hear about it, then it's easy enough to blame it on weather phenomena, Venus, or whatever.
Yeah, those 13 lenticular clouds you saw, Dave, were being affected by swamp gas.
I love the swamp gas. Yeah, yeah. Especially after Mexican and margaritas.
Yeah, oh, yes, there's a lot of swamp gas after Tex-Mex. We have a couple of questions here that I'm going to combine here, Jim, because they're both along the same subject matter, which is wealth and money. One of the members' names is Evasius, and the other one is Admriker 444. Apologies if I've mispronounced either one of your names. It's going to start like this. What exactly drives the ruling elite to amass such unbelievable wealth? Is it merely to obtain more power, or are they using it to build the technology to possibly escape this planet one day, leaving us behind? And then Amberker says, do you think that perhaps getting rid of money would ultimately be the solution to all of the world's problems?
Oh, boy.
Well, don't get rid of mine.
The Bible, yeah, and you got to say, keep it short.
Yeah, Bible, a rug.
The Bible says the love of money is the root of all evil.
Of all
didn't
evil.
Say money, it says it's the love of money. So that leads us to this oligarchy that seems to be ruling the planet, or at least trying to. And obviously, they have all the money. They have more money than Croesus. And that's a good question. Why, if they've already, if somebody's worth $500 million, why do they need any more? And it comes down to, that's one level of understanding today is that, well, it's just greedy people. They want more money, more money. You know, it's kind of like whoever dies with the most toys wins, okay? So they have all the money. But, friends, it's much deeper than that because in today's societies, money means power, and power is what they're after. Not just the power to live in a fancy home or fly in a private jet so they don't have to take their shoes off at the airport like they're making us do,
right.
or drive around in a limousine where they can drink all they want to and they don't have to worry about a DWI. You know, it goes even beyond that. They want the power to control others, mainly us. So it's a control mechanism. Before money, it was religion. That's what gave rise to the great religions of the world, was an attempt to control the population. And they did it through religion. Don't do that or God will punish you. And by the way, I'm a representative of God. I represent God, so don't mess with me. In fact, give me all your money. But during the Reformation and during the Age of Enlightenment, the power of religion began to lose sway as science began to gain credibility and gain adherence. So they had to come up with some other way to control people, and they came up with money, the economy. And today, if you have a lot of money, then you can have a girlfriend, you can have a nice house, you can have prestige, you're somebody. If you have no money, you're nobody. And, of course, that's a terrible state to be in, and you can see where it's getting us. Today, our heroes are people who can act, people who can carry a pigskin 100 yards once a week, and politicians and corporate malfeasance that, you know, otherwise nobody would have any regard for. And now they're our great heroes because they have money. So money is not the object. Money is the means to the end. And to these people at the top of the power pyramid, it's a means of controlling the human population.
Well, you know, speaking of that, it's interesting that you should say that because that gets us to another question from one of our members at AboveTopSecret.com by the name of Good Wolf. And this fits right in, Jim. It says, Mr. Mars, mandatory RFID chips in people in the future are a horrid certainty. Today we have chip pets and other animals in captivity, and chipping immigrants is the next step. But when am I going to be forced to have one, do you believe?
Well, this is the horror of it all. I don't think we're going to be forced to do that. Because, number one, nobody's going to hold me down and put a chip in my arm, all right? We're going to have a heck of a fight first, okay? So I don't think anybody's going to be forced to do that. No, we're going to be manipulated into taking the chip. It's already begun. Club Med, for example, which is, of course, this tour vacation club for mostly young people, they've already instigated chipping their clients. And the way they do this is they say, well, if you'll take the chip, we'll give you discounts on our merchandise. Better yet, you can get to the first of the line. You can go to the head of the line, okay? And as I remember the news story, 30% of their clientele has said, oh, yeah, sure, I'll take the chip. So it's amazing. And, of course, these people, the 30% that are taking the chip, have not read the articles that detail studies showing that in lab animals, chipping, subcutaneous chipping, oftentimes leads to cancer. So that's another reason you don't want it. But here's another thing. Merchants are going to have it. Having run a small business of my own, I can assure you the thing that kills most every business is just debts. You know, people take the merchandise or and then don't pay. The check bounces or the credit card's no good. That debt, that unpaid revenues, can just kill a business. So when they're offered the idea of a chip, and the person comes in and buys that suit of clothes or that dress, and then they scan their chip, it's like a debit card, and before they walk out with your merchandise, the merchant has already been credited with that sale and has the money in his account. And when they come and offer something like that, no amount of moral ambiguity is going to stop those merchants from accepting that. Now, it gets even scarier in that they have now, we're all still thinking about the chip as about the size of a grain of rice, but they've got them down even smaller than that now, to the point to where they say, okay, everybody, go get your flu shot, and with the flu shot comes the chip.
Oh.
Now, I'm not saying that's happening. I'm just saying that that's possible.
Hmm.
But that's pretty scary, isn't it? So we get the chip, and we don't even know it.
Especially for us that are over 55, that they're saying not mandatory, but really strongly recommending that, you know, any of us that are 55 and over, you know, get a flu shot, which I do every year religiously. You know, I would never miss my flu shot. But yeah, I mean, they use now I've seen the needles, but I also a couple of years ago they used that thing they used to use in the military, Jim. If you remember
yeah,
that,
the pneumatic,
the pneumatic
shot arm, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I'm not going to get into it, but I'm going to say this. I will never again take a vaccination or a flu shot or any kind of thing, because if you go back and look at the history of that, well, just think back to last year. In the fall, it was take your flu shot. And then about January, they said, well, you know, that wasn't quite the right formula. You need to go back and take another one.
Right.
You know, well, hey, yeah. They're kind of like doctors. They're just practicing. You know, and I personally don't want somebody practicing with my health and my body. I think I'm going to take control over that myself. And in fact, when the flu shots first came out, my personal experience was that for several years I resisted it, not out of any kind of knowledge or anything. I just didn't want to be bothered with it, and I never got the flu. The first year that my bosses badgered me and said, you really got to have your flu shot. And I went, well, okay. And I went and got the flu shot. Well, I got the flu. Because
right.
after all, a flu shot is the infection, supposedly watered down to the extent to where your body builds up a resistance to it. But hey, essentially they're giving you the flu. So, you know, if you keep your immunization system strong, unfortunately, that means not eating fast foods and, you know, getting a proper amount of sleep and exercise and stuff that none of us really want to do. But if you'll do that, you won't get the flu. You don't need the
flu shot. You know, there are those in the religious community, Jim, that believe that the RFID chip may actually be part of a scriptural prophecy saying that those that do not receive
it.
Yeah, that don't receive the mark of the beast will not be able to purchase, be able to buy, not do commerce at all. Do you think that there actually might be some truth to that?
Actually, I could see that being entirely possible because, again, it's not going to be forced on you. But when you go down and you want to open a bank account or you want to draw your money out and they say, well, scan your chip, and you say, I don't have a chip, and then they say, next,
right.
then you're going to pretty well go for the chip. I've seen this happen over my lifetime. Back in the 70s, when I was doing a little moonlighting at an advertising PR agency, the owner and I would laugh and say, hey, when that World Bank card, credit card comes, don't accept it. But you know what? I now have one. And I never had a chance to say no, because it started off as a local Fort Worth bank. Here, we're going to issue this credit card, and then, that you can keep up with your accounts, and it's going to be so much more easy, and you can carry one little card instead of a wad of cash, all the great excuses. So I had that. And then the next thing I know, I get a letter saying that my credit account had been bought up by Republic National Bank of Dallas.
Hmm.
Well, okay, that's all the way over to Dallas, but, well, that's okay. Next thing I know, a year or so goes by, and I get a letter saying your credit account is now owned by some bank out of Delaware.
Right.
Okay, the next thing I know, it's your bank account is now owned by Citicorp, And all of a sudden, I've got that World Bank card, and somebody's handling my account that's not even in my state, and I never had a chance to say yes or no. And that's what they're going to do with the chip.
Well, before we get off this RFID chip, John, if you'll excuse me, I want to stay on this just one more time. There was a thread on AboveTopSecret.com a couple of months ago that was talking about the possibilities that RFID chips were going to be used in a new child identification program to help preclude kids being kidnapped, you know, the Amber Alert scenario or whatever. Did you happen to, when you were on the site and writing the book Above Top Secret, did you happen to come across that or have your own thoughts about what's being proposed there?
Yes, I have seen that. And, of course, just on the surface, you know, well, let's help find lost children. Well, who can be against that?
Right.
But then that comes back. Everything, it seems, is to save the children.
Right.
Well, you know, who in the world is going to stand up and say, no, I don't give a damn about the children? Nobody's going to do that. So you got to go along with all that. And yet this is just a marketing ploy. This is a manipulation. Because, yeah, save the children, that sounds great. But then as opposed to saying, hey, take this chip and we can follow you and track your movements 24/7. Nobody wants that. But when you say save the children, who can be opposed to that? Go back and look at the landmine issue, okay? Going back to the Reagan years, and we're in the fight against international communism. The United States and United States corporations were manufacturing, planting landmines all over the world to save the children. And then, after about 20 years of horror stories of poor little kids in third world countries being blown up and losing arms and legs because of our landmines, then these very same corporations are now making millions of dollars going around the world digging up the landmines to save the children. It's really a pretty, you know, cold-blooded rationale.
Right.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, but you know, I mean, they're dealing with parents' hearts and whatever, and
exactly.
They're putting us into a psychoanalytical thing, you know, to where we go.
They whipsaw it into an emotional issue, and when your emotions get in the way, then you tend to lose your critical thinking capability.
Right. Exactly.
Because of time constraints, I want to move over to a couple of member questions here that seem to kind of work in the same area and see what your thoughts are on this. Lars Phillips and also The Borg, both their questions kind of tie in with each other, so I'm going
to ask. Well, I don't know if I want to talk to The Borg.
he's safe. Once he assimilates you, you're fine.
Right.
Okay.
Lars Phillips' question is this. Is there an organized group that has an agenda that perhaps counters those of the NWO and the OWG crowd? Do these secret societies have a nemesis? And then the Borg says, with the world situation as it is right now, do you see a way that people can break free from the oppressive hands of these powers? So see how they do kind of combine together. So what are your thoughts on that? Is there a nemesis against these secret societies?
Is there an organization that is fighting against the New World Order, essentially,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm going to answer simply no, and believe me, folks, I have looked for one. And, of course, that does not necessarily mean that one does not exist, because if they are secretive, like the secret societies behind the New World Order, then it could be that we don't know about them. But I don't believe there is, at least consciously, because the secret societies have been at it for hundreds of years, and they've gotten their techniques down pretty good. And one of the things they do is they will form their own counter-organization just to draw in everyone who would join such an organization, and then they have them identified, and they know who to watch out for and who to disrupt. And they do this all the time. This is why, you know, people still haven't broken out of the old Democratic Party, Republican Party paradigm. They really think that these are two separate groups and that one represents one way of thinking and one political path, and the other one, you know, represents something different. Well, they don't. They're all ruled by the same people, the same money elite. And so, unfortunately, when you try to organize and you try to start something. If you'll recall, in the mid-60s, there was a lot of public talk and a lot of media given to the rise of the militias in various states. They were forming these militias, and they said, when this new world order comes and they try to instill martial law and all like that, we're going to resist. We're not going to do that. And then what happened? The Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma blows up. Children are killed, and everybody's horrified. And they try to blame the militias. And that wasn't an entirely successful attempt because they couldn't really nail it on the militias. In fact, it goes back to people who were connected, once again, within our own government, the CIA, and on like that. So, but nevertheless, after that, you didn't hear much about militias anymore, did you?
No.
Yeah. So they know, have all the tools, and they know all the techniques for identifying and disrupting any kind of organized resistance. So back to the second part of the question, what can we do about it? What we do about it is, instead of forming committees and holding conventions and being very organized about it, we simply create a community of like-minded individuals who have access to the same information, can reach the same conclusions, and can come to the same understanding of what the situation is. And then we're back to what I mentioned earlier, which is that we can possibly affect the corporate oligarchs by impacting their profit line, by boycotting products and services that we think are harmful to the people, to the environment, and by supporting the services and goods that we think are of benefit to society.
All right, well, I want to do a minor sidebar before we continue on with the member questions here at AboveTopSecret.com, and that is, when you were first approached by the Amigos to possibly even consider doing the book, which we're talking about, Above Top Secret, which is now available worldwide, how long, you know, I'm just curious, Jim, you know, when you're researching to do a book, and obviously you had a plethora of topics to look at, what was the ultimate factor that made your decision of what chapters you were going to do of the member questions and threads that were started?
Well, first off, let me just tell you why that after I understood the situation, I was very enthusiastic about doing Above Top Secret. And that is simply that when I was first approached with the idea of trying to tackle all of these separate issues, if they are separate, and many of them actually tie to each other, I was a little standoffish, I thought, because in all my previous works, Crossfire, Rule of Secrecy, Alien Agenda, The Rise of the Fourth Reich, it took a laborious amount of research, and because I carefully footnoted everything, anything that somebody might say, why, how do you know that? Or did he really say that? Or whatever. Right. I always had it fully footnoted. And that's why that nobody's been able to attack my work and nobody successfully and in detail. And nobody's been able to attack me because I'm not anybody who's worth attacking. And so they have simply treated me and my work with benign neglect. I don't get any reviews. I don't get on, you know, I don't get on the Tonight Show. I don't get in the national media because they don't want people talking about what I talk about. And they can't refute my information. And by the way, this gives me a great opportunity to say, I don't believe that is not a valid argument. Okay? And I'll accept that. I mean, I accept the fact that anybody can believe whatever they want to, and I'll fight to the death for the right of everybody to believe whatever they want to. But when I research something, find out something that I know to be true, and I say 2 and 2 is 4, don't tell me I don't believe that as an argument, because that's not an argument. That's just a belief system. Wow, and right. I try to avoid that. But
okay.
back to the so when I was approached to write ATS, I'm thinking all of these subjects, all these topics, UFO, who killed Kennedy? I mean, they, you know, you could write several books on any one of these topics.
Right.
But then when I was told, no, this is going to be a quick read overview, and we want your opinion and what you know, And I said, you mean I don't have to footnote everything? And he said, no. And I said, wow, count me in. So I jumped on this. Now, I hasten to add, that doesn't mean that I just made stuff up. Okay?
Right.
Everything in Above Top Secret can be at least attributed, if not documented. Okay?
Right.
So there's not any guesswork or dreaming going on in the chapters dealing with all these subjects that's in Above Top Secret. But what you're going to get are the nuts and bolts. You're going to get the pros and the cons, and it's going to be a quick understanding of all of these topics. For example, one of the topics I deal with, and one of the topics that is of great interest to a great number of people, is what happened, what crashed at Roswell in 1947,
right.
Okay? Well, you know what? I try to reduce things down to its simple, the simple formula. You know, it's either or. So what Roswell does, for example, is come down to the individual's belief system. On the one hand, if you believe the government, which has changed its story on Roswell four times, then and ended up saying they saw crash dummies, even though by the government's own documentation, there were no crash dummy tests until 1954, years after Roswell.
Right.
But if you choose to believe that, then you can believe that nothing unearthly happened at Roswell. But then on the other hand, if you choose to listen to more than 600 individuals that are now on the public record saying, well, I was there, and it was a crash disk, and I saw these small alien bodies, well, then you can believe them. So it kind of comes down to just whatever you want to believe.
Another listener slash member from AboveTopSecret.com asked this question. Mr. Mars, if the Anunnaki landed on the front lawn and said that they were, in fact, man's creators, would the best thing to do would be, one, embrace this, number two, run away screaming Antichrist and hide in a hole, or three, pretend to be intrigued, and then when the chance comes, hide.
No, I'd take number four. I would say be friendly, offer the hand of friendship, but keep your hand on your wallet.
Yeah, really.
No, that's, I remember, I think there was a quote in my book, Alien Agenda, about one of these people who say they have been abducted by aliens. And they kind of ask the question, well, why don't you guys just land and say, here we are, we're neighbors, and we'll all be friends. And the answer was, I think, gets to the crux of the problem. This person was told, well, half the people would fall down and try to worship us as gods, and the other half would try to kill us. And I think that pretty well sums it up. That's why there's not any open contact at this point. And you and the listeners have to understand that, you know, in this country today, in the United States of America, depending on where they landed, it might actually be okay. You know, they'd land and people would kind of gawk and maybe stand back, but then, you know, there wouldn't be any shooting. And I think, especially among young people, I think, oh, there's some aliens, you know. And so
right.
I think that something like open contact could go off fairly smoothly. But you have to understand, the United States is not the world. And
despite what the Congress believes, right?
Yeah, exactly. Despite Congress. And in the rest of the world, particularly third world countries, they are held together by strict religious concepts, and this could cause quite a problem. And I think that that may be one of the biggest stumbling blocks right now to open contact between the Earth and extraterrestrials.
Okay, I'm going to move into another member question. This is from a member, Conspiracy Nut 23. And I'm going to ask this all at once, so be a little bit patient with me, Jim. I didn't go to the Evelyn Wood Reading School of Dynamics as you did.
Okay, just found it out.
All right, very good. Yeah, if I have some problems with the pronouns, you're going to help me, right?
Right.
All right, Mr. Mars, judging from your rule by secrecy, there's little doubt you will confirm that the Fed is indeed a scam. However, there are a few points I am still unclear about. Number one, if each dollar printed comes with a debt in the form of an interest-bearing bond or T-bill, it is, of course, impossible to repay the principal. However, this assumes that no assets is created outside the Federal Reserve. If, for example, a gold mine is discovered, can't this gold be used to pay back the principal? And number two, why does the Federal Reserve give back most of its profit to the Treasury? Is it simply a control mechanism and not in itself a profit maker for the elite?
Okay, let me do a boy.
That's a lot of stuff. Yeah,
really. And keep in mind that I don't claim to be a world class expert in economics. But back to the idea of the gold mine. If the gold found in the gold mine worth whatever it would be worth was handed over to the government, well then, okay, yeah, maybe that would be a way to shore up the Federal Reserve. But the problem is, that ain't what happens. When they find the gold mine belongs to the private individual that found it or is bought up by private individuals. And that money, especially if you got a lot of gold, then that money usually ends up in a bank in the Cayman Islands or somewhere else. It does not end up in the public treasury. There are books written about what happens to gold. If you're really interested in gold, there's a number of books I could recommend, including one called Gold Warriors. You get all of that, you'll find out that that gold does not end up in the public treasury. And then to the second part, what was the second part of that question about the...
Yeah, why does the Federal Reserve give back most of the of its profit to the Treasury, $30 billion a year?
Oh, okay, okay. Yeah, that's, well, that's just a... when you understand who owns the Fed, it's the same people that own the government. So that's just robbing Peter to pay Paul. Pull it out of your left-hand pocket, you put it in your right-hand pocket. That's basically and generally and probably a bad illustration. But that's why, and as the person says, there's no way we can ever pay off the principal. So what they're doing is they're just spreading the interest around, greasing everybody, so the system keeps going. I was just reading the other day about a former IRS worker who is now being jailed for 4 years because she tried to explain to people that the IRS is unconstitutional, illegal, and that the amendment creating it was never legally ratified, which apparently is true. But, of course, that kind of goes back to the old argument about the Constitution was never legally ratified and that legally, technically, we're still operating under the old Articles of Confederation. But the reality is that we claim the Constitution is the basis for our system, and even though it's shredded today, thanks to the past 8 years, and the years even before that, it nevertheless is considered the law of the land, and therefore we just act like it is legal and we go on with it. The same thing apparently is with the IRS. As the movie producer Aaron Russo quite clearly showed, there is no law requiring you to pay income tax. But, of course, if you don't pay it, they'll come after you. They'll seize everything you have, and they'll throw you in jail. So, in practicality, yes, it is valid. And that's the same thing there. So the IRS and the Federal Reserve System, until we can gain control back over the Congress and have them change the rules. For one thing, it would seem to me to be a very simple thing and a prudent matter to simply have Congress order an audit of the Federal Reserve System. How much money you got? What are you doing with it? Where's it going? Are you making a profit? Are you making a loss?
Right.
But do you realize that since the Federal Reserve System was instituted about 1913, that it has never been audited? Nobody knows where all that money goes to. And this, of course, is because the Federal Reserve System, along with Wall Street, the bank, and the City of London, constitutes the inner core of the economic mechanism that these globalists are using to try to gain and maintain control over the world.
Hmm. We have a member by the name of Johnny Canuck who asked this question. Mr. Mars, I'd like to hear your opinion on the whole Reagan White House Franklin cover-up, Johnny Gorsch / Hunter Thompson / Jeff Gannon / Ted Gunderson saga. If this is true, it sounds like a horror story. What are your thoughts?
Oh, my God. Yeah, can I take a minute? Most people who are hearing this question probably don't even know what they're referring to, but this is referring to a lot of documented evidence that seems to point to the idea that at the very top of the American power structure, and I'm not just talking about the White House or the halls of Congress, I'm talking about the people who control them, the people whose names you may or may not know. But if you ever saw, what was the movie with Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman that was the last picture by Stanley Kubrick? Eyes Wide Shut.
Mm-hmm.
If you ever saw that, this is about a New York doctor who just happens to stumble into a very, very high-level, high-dollar group of, I guess, essentially Satanists, people who practice occult magic and practice occult ceremonies. And this is basically what this issue is all about. This brings us to Bohemian Grove and the worship of the owl and the seemingly ritualistic slaying of a victim, which they say doesn't really happen. They're just acting it all out. And gets into the whole allegations of young kids being taken and used in occult rites. This is so dirty, so nasty, that nobody really wants to deal with it. And if the allegations are true and that this type of activity reaches up to the level of the highest power in this country, then you can see both the danger involved in trying to pursue something like this and the problem you would have trying to bring judges and high-dollar lawyers and ranking government officials to try to prosecute their superiors. They're not going to do that. And so it is really, it's a story that begs to be fully investigated in the light of day, brought out. If it can be unfounded, then we need to know that so that we can quit thinking these vile thoughts about some of our highest leaders, both in corporate life and in government. And if it is founded, then we need to clean out that nest of vipers.
Well, I want to correct one thing because I know I'll get 100 U2Us. The movie that came out in 1999 that we were referring to is Eyes Wide Shut, not Wired Shut. Eyes Wide Shut, and it was one of the last films I think Stanley Kubrick did. And you know, the great thing about that particular movie, Jim, that I really liked was the opening scene, and that's all I'm going to say about that. Okay.
Imagine that.
Got to have a little entertainment to help.
Imagine that.
I'm telling you.
As long as you're mentioning that, though, first off, maybe my slurry Texas accent, I hope you guys didn't think I said wired. I meant to say Eyes Wide Shut, but with my accent, it might have come out wired. But I just want to add a little coda on that discussion is that it's my understanding that this was Stanley Kubrick's last film, and I kind of have the idea that he was trying to tell something that he knew to be true through movies.
Right. Oh, yeah.
As we often get truth through movies. But he died, and it was seriously edited and chopped up without his permission, without his knowledge, because he was dead. And so the version that we get is not necessarily the true version, true vision that Stanley Kubrick was working toward.
Right. And I had heard that from a lot of different people. Yeah, I'm a big movie buff, so I mean, I really am into film being fact. You know, I got to ask you one question, John. I know I'm doing the sidebar, and I apologize, but I've got to ask Jim this since we were talking about the UFOs. You know, I had the opportunity to interview Shirley MacLaine some time ago. And in the interview with her, she related to the Washington, D.C. UFO flying saucer scenario. You know, at one time it was really speculated that the day the Earth stood still, was kind of a fabrication of a movie between Hollywood and government trying to see what people's reactions were if, in fact, we were visited by an alien species. Did you ever, in all your investigation, ever come across anything that would substantiate maybe that?
Well, of course, the problem is when you get to questions like that, proof is hard to come by. The illustration I used in my UFO classes is I would pass a quarter around to the class, and everybody hold it up, and they'd look at it, and I'd take it back, I'd put it in my pocket. And then I'd say, okay, ask or tell me something about that quarter. And they'd say, well, it was a 1992 quarter. And I'd say, what quarter? And they'd look at me funny, and they'd say, the quarter you showed us. And I said, I didn't show you any quarter. Well, yeah, you did. You handed it to me. I had it in my hand. Yeah, I said, but where is it now? They said, it's in your pocket. And I said, no, it's not. And we all just stand there and look at each other.
Wow.
And I explained to them that is the problem with some of these issues, particularly UFOs. The government comes, takes them up, and then says they don't have them. And I said, so I say, how are you going to prove I had a quarter in my pocket? I said, the only way you can prove I have a quarter in my pocket is to turn me upside down and shake me until the quarter falls out of my pocket. I said, we cannot turn the government upside down and empty its pockets. We can't do it, so we can't know for certain what's going on. So therefore, we have to just treat things to the best of our knowledge.
And folks, we're going to have to end our show right there. Remember that next week it's going to be part two with Jim Mars, and I'm sure that your brain is on overload as mine is on part one. Is it not, Senior Dave?
It is very much on overload, and I just got to say publicly, John, what a great job you did in tightening up the edits and whatever, and making Jim sound really intelligent.
I don't think he has a problem.
I'm so sorry. Jim, I'm just kidding. You're a fellow Texan. I love you, brother. You know, that was just a joke.
And just a quick reminder, friends, you can pick up that book at Amazon.com, or also we have a link on our thread where you can pick it up through our Above Top Secret store.
That's it for us. I hope everybody had a good time. Be looking forward to part two next week. Till then, I'm Dave Rabbit.
And I'm Johnny Anonymous. Good night, Gladys Jane.
ATS Mix from AboveTopSecret.com is over.
You've been listening to the ATS Mix with Dave Rabbit and Johnny Anonymous. If you have a comment, suggestion, an opposing view, or would like to participate in a future show of ATS Mix, please contact Dave or Johnny at www.abovetopsecret.com. The views expressed on ATS Mix do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of the Above Network, LLC, or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening. You may now reattach your tinfoil hat. Thank you.